Where we go.
Thank you. Again, my name is Ed, and I'm an alcoholic. And hi, everybody. This is quite a privilege when I was asked to go and share for the archives the fact that that I have 42, 43 years. It kind of hit home a little bit. I'm ancient. one of the things that's the bad things about having this kind of length of sobriety is that I've also gotten older. You know, I'm 75 years old. I don't feel it, but I'm 75. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 31. My sobriety date is May 21st, 1971, and it will be 43 years this coming May, by the grace of God. But a brief, I guess a little bit of a brief history of my drinking, so not to take up too much time in that area, but I was born in Union City, New Jersey, October the 14th, 1939, and I picked up my first drink that I recall, January the 1st, 1952. I was 12 years old. And my first drunk, my first blackout, the first of many. Story on that was my dad, we bought a house in a town called Bergenfield, New Jersey, back in 1949. And one of the very first things my dad did was at the cellar down there, he changed it into what he called his rumpus room. He had the wallpaper was pink with yellow giraffes and blue elephants and balloons, and he had a bar that would put some of the gin mills down here in Crystal River to shame. I tell you, he had my God, he had every kind of liquor you could think of, and he would throw parties for any reason at all. He'd just throw a party for just a party guy. He wasn't an alcoholic, not a heavy drinker. Just enjoyed him and mom just enjoyed a good time and enjoyed friends and so on. And every New Year's he would throw a New Year's Eve party. Well, this one particular New Year's morning in 1952, I decided that I was going to be a good little boy and go downstairs in Dad's rumpus room and clean up the party and make it nice and clean for him, so by the time we got up in the morning, that morning, it would be nice and clean. I remember going down there and I'm looking at all these bottles of booze on the bar. I was saying, gee, they having a good time. So I started sampling. A little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit here. You know. I didn't care too much for it, but I hit the bottle of green cream de menthe, and it tasted like toothpaste. I'll never forget it. Well, to make a long story short, the next thing I remember, I'm upstairs and I try going back to bed, but I walked into the wrong room. I walked into my sister's room. She yelled, "Edward, you're drunk." My mother got up. I looked down the stairs. I says, "I didn't know there were two of you." I remember that like it was yesterday. And I was sick as a dog. And I swore I'd never pick up another drink. Well, that didn't last too long. What it did for me that I never forget. Well, let me put this to you. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the first things I heard was that an alcoholic stops maturing emotionally the day they pick up that first drink. And I remembered how I felt back in those days when I was 12 years old. And I always felt like I was the runt of the litter. Like nobody really liked me. I really didn't fit in. I was very uncomfortable in my own skin. And as a result of that, I was very uncomfortable with any kind of an attitude that I thought maybe you might have of me. And I remember when I picked up that drink, it was like being shot out of a cannon. It was like being set free. I loved life. I liked me. I was comfortable and so on. And in hindsight, I guess it would be true of my experience that I spent the next 19 years trying to relive that first experience of what I thought was freedom. And as a result of that, I spent the next 19 years in and out of jails, in and out of mental hospitals, in and out of automobile accidents, in and out of marriages. I'm not going to get into too much detail on it, with the exception of, I can tell you this, that there was a good portion of my life where I had both the good guys and the bad guys after me. So I really had no place to go in that area there. I got to like Babbage so much, I kept on doing it over and over and over again. It didn't last too long. I was an alternating coward when I was not drinking, and a real wise guy when I was drunk. Back and forth, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde type of a fellow on that there. I don't know what it's like to drink sociably. I don't know what it's like to have one or two or three or four and say, no, I had enough. But I do know what it's like to crave that alcohol to the point where that's the only thing that's important in my life, that's the only focus I have, the only reason that I have for living. I know what that's like. I know what it's like to have the fears of not having that next drink. I know what it's like to go and wake up in the middle of the night and look at a bottle of booze and see it half empty. Now I see things as half full, but then as it was half empty, and wondering where I was going to get the money or whatever to go and get that alcohol. You know, I know what it's like to be alone in a crowded room and to have fears of the boogeyman all over the place. And I know what it's like I don't know what's wrong with me. I have to use this expression, ladies. I apologize. I don't know what's wrong with me. I said, when I was younger, I used to be full of piss and vinegar, and now I'm afraid of my own shadow. I know what that's like. And I know what it's like to go and have that drink and have all that go away for the first two or three drinks. I know what that's like. And I know what it's like to go and wake up the next morning and be full of fears because I didn't know where I was the night before and what I did, and I knew full well that when I was getting to that particular state, I was very, 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 very capable of extreme examples of antisocial behavior. We'll leave it at that. I know what that's like. I know what it's like to wind up in jail and not knowing why I got there. You know, I know what it's like to go and be facing a long time in jail because of what I did when I was drunk. You know, I never woke up in the morning and said, gee, you know, I got everything a man could ever want. I got a wife, I got a couple of kids, I got a good job, I got a good reputation in the community. I think I'm going to get drunk today and screw it all up. I never said that. Never said that one time. I never had any intention of getting drunk and fouling up my life. That was never my goal in life. But that's what happened. That's exactly what happened. I used to, towards the end, I would drink for the purpose of getting the edge off, just to feel normal, so that I could cope with life on life's terms. That was my whole purpose of drinking towards the end. But once I would pick up that drink, I just could not stop. I couldn't stop. I drank past the point of getting drunk. Wasn't like I'd say, well, I think I'm gonna tie a load on today and have a good time. That wasn't the underlying motive of my drinking. It was to get the edge off, and then once I drank that alcohol, I just couldn't stop. I would remember sitting in the bar and drinking till 2-3 o'clock in the morning, and finally pushing the stool away and hitting my belly like this, like I had a full steak dinner. I was now full, my system was satisfied. Had nothing to do with being drunk up here. Didn't understand that. My last drunk was in 1971, by the grace of God. Now, at that point in time, I had already been married twice and divorced twice. I had a couple of children all over the place, New Jersey, whatever. And I had been in and out of jails and so on. And I was going with this young lady who now is my wife, Mary Ellen. She was supporting me. I was a regular gigolo. She paid my rent for me. She put money in my pocket. She would come over to the place where I lived after work, and she would help me get dressed. And She bought me my clothes. Then she put $20 in my pocket. We'll go in a car and we'll go into a gin mill. And then she sit there with me till 2 o'clock in the morning and they'll let me be any person I wanted to be, but who I really was. And that was the extent of those times drinking. And what happened at I totaled out her automobile, and it was a point then that she had enough of me. And she was my ace in the hole. And she left me. And for the first time in my life, I was truly alone. My mother and father owned a restaurant in this particular town in Long Island. I was barred from my father's own restaurant. My old man barred me from his gin mill. Can you believe? What an insult. I couldn't. That really hurt. Really hurt. And I remember that last week walking the streets of this town that I lived in, sleeping in the back of automobiles, breaking into a person's home through the basement window to sleep next to an oil burner to stay warm. And in Long Island in May, could be a cold month, could be cold. I remember doing that. And the night before I called up AA, I went into my favorite gin mill, and I had just totaled out her car the week before, and I was all in pain. And I went in there and I started drinking vodka and beer chasers, and John, his bartender, he turned to me and he says, "You know what your problem is, Ed?" And I says, "No, what?" He says, "That's your problem right there." I says, "Oh, you're full of so-and-so." "It is not." Then he said, "Last call," and I says, "Back me up with 10. Uh-huh. 2 o'clock in the morning, 10 vodkas and beer chasers. That wasn't my problem at all, right? Anyway, next morning, got up and I walked, sick as a dog, 7:30 in the morning to this particular gin mill, and I had about $1.30 left in my pocket. A ball and a beer in those days was 65 cents. A shot of vodka and a little beer chaser was 65 cents. And I walked into this place called the Home Johnny Allen's Eagle Rest. He's gone now. It's so many years ago. And I sat at the corner of the bar, and I ordered a vodka and a beer chaser, and I drank it. And I looked in the mirror, and I was looking at myself. I said, "God, man, my ankles were swelled out like this. My stomach was, I had about a 44-inch waist. I had a 15-inch collar. I was 130 pounds. I showed my friend back there a picture of me when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. If you all would like to see it afterwards, I'll be more than happy to show it to you. It's my last mugshot." All right? And I remember saying to myself, just, "God, you're 31 years old. You got nobody. You're alone. No job, unemployable. Cops are after you. The bad guy, and the bad guys were, they really were after me. That's a miracle. We'll leave that alone because of this thing here. But that's a miracle. What you know? And now the girl that you really loved, she's out of your life totally. What are you gonna do?" About a week before, my mother threw me out of a restaurant. Says, "Go to Jersey. Go to hell. Go to AA. But get the hell out of our lives," quote unquote. And it's funny how you can remember things even in a blackout, huh? I'm looking in the mirror, and this voice that now today I know is God, though at the time I wanted nothing at all to do with him. In fact, in those days there, I went the other way. I got involved in what they call the left-hand path, which was horoscopes and witchcraft and all that sort of stuff. I was bad stuff. So when it came to God, that was not my cup of tea. But I remember looking at the mirror, and his voice says, "Call AA." And I was immediately filled with a sense of calmness that I almost thought to cry today after all these years, how intense it was. And so I went over and I went to the phone booth in the back, and I reasoned out, "Oh, wait a second now, a bowl and a beer is 65 cents and all I got left is 65 cents. So I called up the answering service, "Collect." I reversed the charges. And this guy gets, he says, hey, this guy is calling collect. He's calling from a gin mill. And this guy gets on the phone and he says, yeah. And I said, what? All I could say was, help. I just yelled, help. Now, AA in those days, in 1971, especially out in Suffolk County, Long Island, and I can only share with you the picture I have of AA meetings to those meetings that I went to. Long Island, New York City, New Jersey, Connecticut, that area there. Atlanta, Georgia, Dallas, the East Coast, back from in those days. So I can't give you a picture. I have no opinion about how AA, quote, really was back in 1971 as a whole. It's different. We're homogenous. It all depends upon what locations we're in. We can see that down here in Florida. Then we had, in Suffolk County, Long Island, we only had maybe 15 or 20 groups at the time, in a population of almost a million people, I guess. And there was no answering service, there was no intergroup. There was answering service, but there was no intergroup. The intergroup was in New York City. So what we had for that particular area is that there was a garage in Central Islip, Long Island. It was called Matt Farrell's. See, I can name these names because they're all gone today. Right? But it was called Matt Farrell's. And what we used to do was there would be a big black couch in the sitting room of this garage where they were fixing cars and stuff like that. And it would be a telephone and a coffee pot, and a bunch of AAs would sit there during the day and they would wait for a 12-step call. That's how we had 12-step calls in those days. Well, that garage was about 25, 30 miles away from where I called from in this particular town. Like, I tell you, just like Ronkonkoma, Long Island. And the guy said to me, he's okay. He says, we'll be there. So I went back to the bar, and I sat there with an empty shot glass and 65 cents left in my pocket, and with the absolute intention of having one more drink before you came to pick me up. And I never had that opportunity. Now, you got to figure, by the time they got into the car and traveled all that, and it wasn't on a highway. These were little town roads to go to get to where I was. Anybody who's ever been out in that area knows what I'm talking about. But I never had an opportunity to pick up that drink. Never had an opportunity. This guy walks in. He looked like Mad Mountain Dean out of a wrestling match. Big Tom. Never forget him. And I'm sitting there like this here, and I'm looking up at him, and he's looking at me like this. And I says, are you from AA? He says, yeah. I says, can I have one more? No. And that was the last, by God's grace, I haven't had a drink since. Well, they I was so far gone, they figured that the only way that they were going to have any help for me was to put me into a rehab. And in those days, we didn't have rehabs like we have now. An alcoholic, when he wanted to go and dry up, we were put, quite frankly, where I think we belonged, or where I belonged, and that was in a mental hospital. And there was two or three of them in that area. Central Islip was one of them, and that's where I went. And they put me into men's admissions in Central Islip for the third time. I went in for alcoholism, with the intention of going over to what they called D4 in those days, which was the only rehab we had for people who were chemically addicted to various substances, alcohol being one of them, drugs and so on, everything else like that. And so I went into the hospital. Well, what I had forgotten about was that I was supposed to go appear in court a couple of weeks earlier than that for a DWI that I had gotten a year or so earlier. After drinking 16 or 17 martinis, the cops thought maybe I shouldn't drive. I didn't know why, you know. And they had a warrant out for my arrest. And so I spent a day or 2 days, then they put me upstairs. And they told me that there was a warrant out for my arrest, I had to put me in a locked ward on the third floor with paper slippers and a bathrobe. And I was behind bars in a mental hospital for 19 days, waiting for the police to pick me up on a charge that I didn't know what I did. Also knowing full well that when I was drunk, I was capable of doing some serious things, not good things. So I think I reached the bottom. I know I'm a low bottom drunk. I was released from that hospital on June the 19th, 1971, right into the arms of the Suffolk County Police. And I was, another miracle happened. I went before the judge and I found out it was a warrant for failure to appear in court. And the judge said to me, and this judge I went before was known as the hanging judge in Suffolk County, Long Island. He would hang his mother just to make a point. And no, I'm serious. This guy was mean. And he looked at me and he said to me, he says, "What do you think we ought to do with you?" And I didn't want to drink anymore because while I was in that hospital, I had made my first meeting exposure to AA from groups that would go into the hospitals to share. And I so identified with the speaker, with the lack of self-worth and the fears and the tears and so on. I knew I was an alcoholic. Or I knew that AA could help me. So when the judge asked me what they thought they should do with me, I says, "I would like you to put me in the county jail until my trial date." And he says, "Well, why should we do that?" I said, "Well, because I don't want to drink anymore. And I'm afraid that if I stay outside, I will." And he released me in my own cognizance. So now I'm back over at my father's restaurant. He's got my bags packed. He's going to go and send me back to New Jersey. You get out of Lake Ronkonkoma because I'm a disgrace to the family. I'm a disgrace to everybody. And I don't blame him. He was absolutely right. I mean, I threw away a career, college education at Tufts University because they wouldn't accept me on my terms. That's, we talk about pride. That was a big disappointment to him for those 31 years. And I was getting into the car and a telephone rings. And lo and behold, the guys that went and 12-stepped me on the 21st of May, 19 days earlier, call up and say, "Am I there?" And they came over and they convinced my father to let me live and stay in Lake Ronkonkoma so that they could take me to meetings. And I remember turning to my dad and saying to him, I says, "Pop," I says, "let me stay." I says, "I want to be able to walk down the streets of this town and look everybody in the eye." I never forget that. And for those next 6 months, in the back of this restaurant was a beer shed. And he put an army cot back there. And he had a light bulb that came down, and on the wall were these empty cases of Ballantine ale. And that's where I slept for the first 6 months of being an Alcoholics Anonymous. And he says, I made a meeting, I was there, I stayed there. The old man said to me, he says, "I'm going to give you 25 cents a day, you SOB." I says, "25 cents?" "Yeah," he says, I'm going to give you a news day, and your mother's going to go and fix you a bag of lunch, for lunch. I says, "What for?" He says, "Well," he says, "you're going to get up in the morning." He says, "You're going to have a breakfast." He says, "You're going to go and look at the want ads, and you're going to find yourself a job." He says, "Then you're going to call them up on the phone, and you're going to ask for an interview, and you're going to walk there." I said, "Well, what's the 25 cents for?" "Well, in those days, a dime for a phone call." He says, "It's 15 cents for a cup of coffee to have with the bag of lunch your mother's going to make you, and a dime is for the phone call." I says, "What phone call?" He says, "Well, I kind of figured that you'll be damn tired by the time 5 o'clock comes around looking for a job. Call me on the phone, I'll pick you up and take you home." And that's the way I was treated. Tough love. And I loved it. And so that day that these guys came over, and Tom got a hold of me when he came over. He said, "This is a so that's miracle number three. Miracle number four. The guys never came over to the hospital to visit me when I was there. Tom gets a hold of me and he says, "It's amazing." I says, "What's that?" He says, "I'm at work." He says, and his voice kept on saying to me, "Call up Central Islip State Hospital and ask to speak to Eddie." He says, so I couldn't help it. I said, finally, he says, on my lunch break, he says, I went and I called up and I found out that you were released. There's a miracle for you. And as, otherwise, I don't know where I'd be today. Maybe I'd be the Oprah, I don't know. So anyway, that was miracle number four. I made my first AA meeting that night. Now, I'm going to ask to go and kind of share a little bit about what AA was like back in those days. And I want to kind of understand something right now. This has to do with just my experience with how it was in that particular area I went to. In 1971, there were very, very, very few meetings that started at 6 o'clock at night. 90% of them were 9 o'clock at night. And the reason for it being was that the idea was back in those days that, well, you know something, you're going to pick up a newcomer to take him to a meeting. He probably will be working. He's got a family life for those. So they'll work. By the time they get home, you want him to have a bite to eat with his family. We go to pick him up, because in those days, you never made a meeting alone. You were picked up and you were taken home. That's the way it was done in those days, at least where I'm from. He says, and you pick up the newcomer and you take him to a meeting. You have a meeting in the car. You pick him up at 8 o'clock. And then you get to the meeting at 9 o'clock. The meeting didn't end at 9 o'clock, at 10 o'clock. There was no such thing as no soul saved after 10 o'clock. That didn't exist. These meetings went on and on until either you said, "Hey, I got to go home," or everybody had a chance to share, which was my saving grace. And they figure, well, you pick up the newcomer, you take him to the meeting at 9 o'clock. You get him home at maybe 10:30, 11 o'clock. He's tired. By the time he gets into his house, he says, most of the gym will be closed at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. He'll only have a few hours left. The chances are pretty good we maybe can keep him sober one more day. That was the whole idea. I mean, that's the way it was explained to me by the old-timers. The guy that 12-stepped me and was my sponsor, Big Tom, he had 5 years at the time. And he's the one that told me all these stories that he said his sponsor told him, who was sober 20 years at the time, that his sponsor said to him, his sponsor told him. So I'm only going by what they told me. That goes all the way back to God knows when, to the really early, early days of AA. So the meetings would start at 9 o'clock. And we had in those days then very keep it simple meetings, at least in this area. We never got in touch. We never got into touchy-feeling meetings or topic discussion meetings. There weren't too many open discussion meetings in those days. Very, very, very few. The concept was that alcoholism was a family disease, and as such, besides Al-Anon, AA could offer family recovery. So the open meetings were what we call speaker meetings. An open meeting was where surrounding groups would come in, and it was usually in a group of three, a leader and two speakers. And then the alcoholic was encouraged to bring his spouse down. On their anniversary, he was encouraged, or she was encouraged, to bring the family down. Many an anniversary I had with my wife and children, sharing my recovery. It was a wonderful thing. Many a Saturday night, my wife and I would go to an open meeting in a Lake Ronkonkoma group as a night out. We would be with other husbands and wives and we'd go to the diner afterwards, or we'd go bowling, or we'd go to the movies together, or go to restaurants together as couples. It was a wonderful thing. The Lake Group that I belonged to just celebrated 62 years. It was back a long, long time. There was a point in the membership there. We had, oh my God, we had, this is no exaggeration, we had about 160 members in this one group. And we had a big, big hall in the church, and it was so big in the closed meetings that we had, that we would have it separated into 1, 2, 3, 4, I think 8 or 10 big tables, and each table would sit 10 to 12 people, and we'd have different discussion meetings going all the way around. We had the speaker meeting, or the open meeting. Then we had the closed meeting, and the closed meeting was two types of closed meetings. We had a step meeting, and we had a regular closed discussion meeting for alcoholics. And during that closed discussion meeting, you could discuss pretty much what was on your heart. Most of the meetings we had in closed discussion meetings in those days were based upon our daily experience on how we were coping with life on life's terms without picking up a drink, which was really a learning experience. We weren't reluctant to talk about our negative days or our negative feelings or our imperfections or our humanities. We were very open about that, and it was very rewarding. At least in my experience, that's the way it was. And we had the step meetings. We had the beginners meetings. And now I'm talking about it in the early days, 1971, 72, 73, 74, 75, those first couple of years. We had the beginners meetings. Now, the beginners meetings had a format to them. AA in those days was very purist. I think it's the best way you can express it, very purist. We really followed the suggestions as outlined from GSR. At the beginners meetings, we would have a person would, I think at the time it was a minimum of 5 years that person had, and he or she was the chair of the beginners meeting. Mm-hmm. Well, we didn't have guest speakers come in. That particular person who chaired it was really he or she would qualify for a few minutes, and then it would be opened up to a question and answer as to what AA was all about. And so on. That's the way it evolved into regular meetings after a while. We always made meetings together. I didn't have an automobile for the first... Well, Mary came back into my life a year later. We got married a year after that. She had the car. I was still a gigolo a little bit there. Huh? I was still mongoing a little tiny bit there, huh? All right, that's an Italian expression for he knows. Okay, all right, okay. But up until that point in time, I'll be honest with you, I made, and not by choice but by design. Most of us, the guys that we came in with, 10 little Indians, they called us. 7 of us are still sober after all these years. 7 of us. 2 died and 1 went out. We made over 400 meetings a year. I remember losing my job, and I got a hold of my sponsor, Big Tom. And he says, Tom, I lost my job. I don't, he says, well, that's all right. That's good, kid. He says, now you can make 3 meetings a day. I couldn't accept too much of a notion of God at those times. And they were really had a lot of wisdom. This guy, Big Tom, got a hold of me. And he says to me, Yeti, he says, tell me something. He says, I'm going to ask you 3 questions. I says, yeah, Tom. He says, you were drunk because I didn't know what alcoholism was all about. And he said, I says, yeah. He says, okay, for you stupid, that's the first step. He says, your life all fouled up? I said, well, gee, you're in and out of jail and in the hospitals. He says, okay, for you, stupid, that's the second half of the first step. He says, do you believe AA can keep you away from one drink one day at a time? Well, after 2 or 3 weeks, I says, yeah, of course I do. He says, okay, for you, stupid, that's the second step. I said, okay. He says, are you willing to do whatever AA asks you to do to stay away from one drink one day at a time? And I says, you betcha so-and-so. He says, okay, for you, stupid, that's the third step. He says, you rest on that understanding of the first three steps for however long it takes. You're not in a race to go and see who can do the 12 steps fastest. For however long it takes, and you'll start to see, there was a sign we used to have, it says, I see things differently now. And he says, then you'll start to see things differently, and you'll start to experience the steps. He says, make a meeting a day for as long as it takes. He says, don't rest on your laurels. Join a group. Get involved. Kept it very, very simple, and that's what I did. Over the year, we'd make meetings together. We made meetings. We would get into a station wagon, make meetings in Connecticut, South Jersey, Manhattan. We would leave 4 o'clock in the afternoon. We'd have a 7 or 8 of us and my sponsor's station wagon going all over the tri-state area. And we did it in those days. I had an opportunities of going and being down south with my job at the time. I made meetings in Atlanta, Georgia. I had the honor of meeting the gentleman in the big book called The Southern Gentleman. The mayor of Anniston, Alabama. I had an honor of meeting him in 1976. God's been very good to me. The meetings down there in Irvington, Texas, up Alabama in the early 70s were the same as I had up in New York. They were still... Open meeting was for family night. Closed meetings were step meeting or a discussion meeting. And the open discussion meeting started to come in the mid-70s more and more to the point where they overcame the regular family meeting, which to us was what we call the showcase of AA. And the 9 o'clock meetings started to phase out too. They became less and less and less. They went to 8:30, then 8 o'clock, then 7:30, 7 o'clock, 6 o'clock. All good times. They're all great times. 5 o'clock in the morning is a great time to have a meeting. They're all great times. The problem that I seen was that they were being shifted. They weren't being balanced out. Now, I'm going to tell you the reason why I'm prejudiced in this area. I got married and I didn't have too much of a experience as far as jobs are concerned outside of stealing and getting drunk and tending bar. And I couldn't do any of those three things because I wouldn't stay sober. I couldn't tend bar anymore. I was good, and my sponsor said to me, he says, go ahead. And he says, but I'm going to ask you a question. I said, yeah, what's that? He says, say, you're behind the stick. He says, and a tragedy happens. He says, and the telephone is 50 feet away and a bottle of booze is 5 feet away. What's going to be easier to pick up? So I never bothered tending bar again. I stayed away. Did what I was told to do because I didn't want to drink anymore. And I got a job. I opened up the Newsday one day and I got a job and it says, Mary, look at this. This guy's crazy. What? It says, organ and piano salesman wanted. No experience necessary. I didn't know a black key from a white key. I said, I haven't got any experience in pianos and organs. I said, anybody that's crazy enough to put an ad like that in the paper is going to hire me. So I went over, it was Worlds of Music Stores in the mall. You know, I'm telling so much of a story that anybody who's been up in a, here will remember me. And believe it or not, I got that job. to sell organs and pianos. And there I am in the mall with two fingers going, blue Spanish eyes, bum, 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 bum. And I fell in love with music. And I wound up going to DeKalb, Illinois. I wound up being sales manager for Worldser, sales coordinator. I wound up winning a trip to the Bahamas. Company paid expenses to the Bahamas as one of the 12 top salesmen for Worldser music stores in the country, the whole thing. But the offside was my hours were from like 9 o'clock in the morning till 10 o'clock at night. Meetings are important to me. I never missed a meeting. Never missed a meeting. Because this whole thing about no soul saved after 10 o'clock didn't exist in those days. Mm-hmm. And those meetings went on until 10:30, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock at night. I could finish work. I could get to my group. Sometimes just in time for the Lord's Prayer at 10:30 at night. And they would tease the hell out of me. Hey, Eddie, you finally made the Lord's Prayer, huh? You know? But I got there, and a meeting is a meeting is a meeting. Don't matter whether it's 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock, I made a meeting. Because we didn't have to I didn't have to worry about, oh, there's no meetings now, it's 9 o'clock at night. Never missed a meeting. The changes, if you want to call it that, started to happen, the way I understand it and see it, about the same time that we started to have the growth of rehabs. And we started to lose the ability of having that first contact with the alcoholic that was looking for help, the 12-step work. Mm-hmm. Up until those days, 90% of the 12-step work was done by an AA member. We'd go two or three of us, sometimes 3 o'clock in the morning, to the person's house. Sit with them, take them. I used to have, and I'm not the only one. I used to have I would ask my wife permission, but I used to have drunks stay at my house for 2 or 3 weeks at a time. 2 or 3 weeks at a time. We all did. That's the way we did it. Recovery rate. I'm going to tell you something. I don't know what. I don't know about statistics that much. I really don't. I don't know how true it all really is, whether it's 35% today or 25, or even what it was. They claimed to have been back in the early 70s at 75% the first time around and 90% the second time around. That's the way it was explained to me. I don't know. I've never seen it in black and white, but that's the way it was told to me. But the changes that we've seen, the influx of a change of attitude towards more moderate viewpoints as far as problems other than alcohol didn't really start to take hold of AA until the advent of this proliferation of rehabs. Not that they're wrong. Don't get me wrong. They're not. They're wonderful. They're wonderful. It was just a matter, I think, over a period of time of taking two sources of recovery and trying to get them to work with each other rather than fight each other. Just like Wilson says, we're not to fight other avenues of recovery, but to try to work together. And I really think in hindsight that was what we were going through, was a learning experience on trying to work with that. So I see that period if you want to call it conflict, if you want to use that expression, okay, as just just trying to work with each other on this here. I remember at the Lake Group we had a bunch of young folks would come in from Apple. Rehab, and they would come down because they were told that a drug is a drug is a drug is a drug. I'm not saying it's not. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying a drug is a drug is a drug, and alcohol is but another form of a drug of choice. And so you can go and make AA meetings. They were told by their counselors. So they would come down and they would start insisting about talking about drugs I'm not talking about duly addicted now. Don't get me wrong. I'm not talking about a person who comes in and says, hey, because I am. I have problems other than alcohol. All right? These are folks who are coming in and just insisting that they were going to talk about their drug addiction or Overeaters Anonymous would come in. And so we had a steering committee. And during one of the steering committees, I happened to have picked up a pamphlet called Problems Other Than Alcohol by Bill Wilson. I don't know where it is. And in there, he talks about how we have to watch about an AA group becoming a multi-purpose group. That we have to keep AA. We can't be better to do one thing well than a lot of things poorly. That we have to stay focused on the message that we're specialists in alcoholism and a particular type of disease called alcoholism. And we say, well, rather than tell these people to get out that you're not wanted here, because really, in a sense, they weren't really there to go and destroy us. They were looking for help just like we are. They just happened to have been in the wrong doctor's office. That's all. So what we would do is that we would read that particular passage at every open meeting and every closed meeting. And that took care of the situation as far as what we were concerned. Today, I look at Alcoholics Anonymous through these eyes that I've just talked to you about. And to be frank with you, I think we've done a damn good job. We still carry that pure message. The core of AA is still as solid and as pure as it was back when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. The formats are different. We are more tolerant of folks who have problems other than alcohol, and rightly so. I mean, nobody's coming in here to destroy us. They're here to... I never ask a person to leave, but I will go and talk to them outside and try to help them go to the right doctor's office. Because, I mean, that's really all they want, you know? So, that's my story. Thank you very much for the ability and the opportunity to share with you.
Thank you, Ed. Thanks very much. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Eddie. That was awesome. Very much enjoyed. Yes, I'm also like late.